Most goods used by organizations, large and small, pass through a warehouse. Customs and Border Protection is an unusual case. Daily, it seizes illegal assets from travelers carrying drugs, weapons, or prohibited items like live animals. Everything goes to one of CBP's secure vaults, and it all has to be tracked. For details, I spoke with the director of the Fines, Penalties, and Forfeitures Division for Cargo and Conveyance Security at Customs and Border Protection, Lisa Santana Fox. And let's start with the mission and activities of the division itself to kind of set the table for us. What happens there? It sounds like an area of CBP that a lot of people aren't familiar with, going through airports and that kind of thing.
Right. So we're kind of like the behind the scenes, right? So you see the officers on the front line, the Border Patrol agents, right? That's who people most commonly identify with CBP, come through the airport. They also work on the cargo side of the house at seaports, right, where we have goods coming into the U.S. The officers and agents on the front line, they encounter merchandise that is violative for whatever reason. We enforce laws for a myriad of other government agencies, right? So they identify the violations and make a determination whether or not we should seize the goods. Really, that we're making a determination, is it admissible into the commerce? Some things may be admissible and need to be corrected, or they're missing some form of documentation. Others are just prohibited, like narcotics. So the officers make that determination to seize. And then once they make a determination to seize, they turn it over to somebody in the fines, penalties, and forfeitures world. Typically, that's the seized property specialist. They're responsible for making sure that what the goods that we are seized are inventoried properly and accounted for. And then the movement of those goods, and depending on the type of merchandise, either movement of those goods to a CBP permanent vault or to a general contractor that handles, low risk merchandise.
Right. So someone bringing a duffel bag full of live chickens, you know, from the Middle East or something. And this actually happens from time to time, live things that are simply not allowed in the country for a variety of reasons, agricultural rules. That's the type of thing that would be shunted aside before it even makes it out to the sidewalk in the
Correct.
Airport.
And right. So in an airport environment, we might see like meat products or other kind of things that could have potential agriculture impact. You know, obviously narcotics, but we also seize a lot of counterfeit goods in all of our environments.
And at the point of seizure, say at a ship entry or even a land entry, I suppose for that matter, or airport, what happens initially to that item or items such that you'll be able to find it again and know what the disposition of it is later on down the line as it gets transported physically from place to place?
Right. So the first step in that process is the officer. We have a system of record. It's called CCATS. It used to have, we used to spell it out, but now it's just been abbreviated and we just refer to it as CCATS. That's our system of record for all of our seizures, fines, and penalties. They initiate the seizure action, and that's what starts the process. Once they've completed that input, it generates a number based on the fiscal year and the port of entry where the goods were seized and taken into custody. And that's the number that we use to track it all the way through final disposition, whether that's destruction or there are some merchandise that we can actually sell that goes to the government auction, right, to be sold. And then that money gets put back into the Treasury Forfeiture Fund.
Is this something that has to do with a barcode or an RFID type of tag, or what's your system at this point?
So I'm ashamed to say, but our system at this point is we track by that seizure number. It's labor intensive, as you can imagine. Given the number of seizures we have in any given year, it's an incredible workload. We are currently piloting the use of RFID tags so that when it goes into, especially for, at this point, we're looking at our high-risk properties. So narcotics, jewelry, firearms, putting RFID tags on that so that it goes into the warehouse. We do annual inventories. So we are constantly doing inventories to make sure that we still have possession of what we've seized until the case is finally adjudicated and forfeiture is affected. Or if it has to go for destruction, there's another inventory process there. So we feel that the RFID is going to be a good option for us going forward to speed up that inventory process.
Right. So you're kind of in two worlds now, a more modernized world of RFID tags and the old world of a number that someone reads. Any way of machine reading the old numbers now, or is it just manual? Sounds like clipboards.
Well, we've got a little more savvy than that, right? We're using, we're using tablets, right, to go into the vaults. So you could imagine what a vault, you know, we're talking, I don't even know how many feet, but it's at least 2 feet thick walls, right? So getting Wi-Fi in some of those locations has been a challenge, but working on automating that process as much as we can. We do use barcodes and barcode scanners on our packaging for some of the seized property. We are currently looking into the use of a QR code to cut down on the number of times we have to write things down, whether it's a case number or what's in the seizure. If it's 5 kilos of cocaine, you know, being able to read that through a QR code and expedite the processing as we go through the case.
Sure. And give us a sense of the extent of the infrastructure for this. You mentioned, you know, a warehouse that might have really thick walls because it's federally secured facility, unlike, you know, somewhere like a train station or something. How extensive are these places? Do you have a lot of them around the country? And how do you make sure that you know what's where?
So we do have permanent seizure vaults across the country in ports of entry. We typically don't disclose the locations specifically, but that's where we keep our high-risk property. So guns, drugs, and currency or jewelry, anything, you know, high value. We do have a general property contractor. We don't actually own the contract. It's under Treasury, under the TEOF, the Treasury Executive Office of Asset Forfeiture. Right. So TEOF has the contract. They have the general contractors. So things like intellectual property goods, a lot of times we use them for special merchandise. Currently, there's a lot of initiatives around hydrofluorocarbons, which are refrigerants. They are technically hazmat, so they have to have special storage requirements, so they go to special contractors. We seize boats, we seize airplanes. Those require special storage. So the network really is extensive. It's just the level of control, the high-risk stuff we keep really close to the vest. And then the general property, we share the wealth with other contractors around the country.
Right. And so you also have a kind of multimodal endpoint for all of these things. Some, as you say, are destroyed. Some might, you know, by incineration, perhaps. An airplane you'd probably sell, you know, mm-hmm. or a boat for sale. And I've known people that have bought government-sold boats and cars over the years. And some things maybe get returned to the owner at some point. I don't know, maybe that's a possibility. But there's many. They all go in one way and go out many ways. And I imagine that's kind of an important thing to track from a data standpoint.
You know, absolutely. We take our mission very seriously. And when you're depriving citizens of their property, right, we're charged with making sure it's secure until the final disposition of the case. So, you know, for certain things, agricultural products that potentially have pathogens, right, those are destroyed typically immediately. We don't want them introduced into the agriculture, the U.S. agriculture. Narcotics, Schedule 1, Schedule 2, so any serious narcotics, we typically destroy them as quickly as possible because the risk they present. But other things, they could be sold at auction. We sell things that could be introduced into the commerce of the U.S. Maybe they just need to have, again, they're missing the wrong forms or they're not a certification from another agency. Some things are not going to be admissible into the U.S., but we can sell them for export to other countries. So the case processing, that number that I talked about at the time of seizure, that's the number that translates all across the process until the final adjudication. We have a petition process where if we see something, the alleged violator has the opportunity to file a petition and say, hey, I didn't know this was wrong. Let me fix it. Or, you know, I didn't get my certificate. I have it now. If I pay a penalty, can I have my things back? We seize a lot of stolen vehicles going outbound out of the country, right? So those typically get turned over to the state and local authorities so that they can be returned to the rightful owner. But that case number is how we keep track of it all the way through final disposition.
So yes, it's almost a case management tracking system, but the cases are physical things that are associated with individuals. So yeah, multidimensional there. And what are your pain points then at this point for this whole process? You mentioned it's labor intensive, a lot of tracking and entering numbers, that kind of thing. What else?
I mean, I think volume. So if you're not in the trade world, this is going to sound really crazy, but we call this de minimis. There was a law that changed under TIFTIA back in 2016, and it raised the threshold for what we call de minimis shipments up to $800. So think of, I go on an electronic platform and I order a pair of shoes, right? The shoes cost me $250. They can come into the US free of duties, taxes, and fees. So between, you know, the change in that, the pandemic, and the explosion of e-commerce, the volume of packages coming in have presented a serious challenge for us, because the risk is the same regardless of it's a, you know, a 40-foot container full of one product or a 40-foot container full of 40,000 products, right? Our risk has not changed. So volume is a big thing for us. And so finding ways to expedite our internal processes, like inventory. Say we get a shipment, I'm currently in LA right now. This is a common thing here where we'll get a container full of goods that are declared as plastic hair clips. We pop open the container, it's full of blue jeans. And so clearly we have a violation. The goods are being smuggled. You know, we have to figure out why they're being smuggled. Sometimes it's just to avoid duty. It could be to avoid forced labor laws that we are enforcing, right? But that 40-foot container, we have to inventory that and to be able to keep track of that through the final disposition. So if I seize a 40-foot container and it has 100,000 pieces, if for some reason I were to give it back to the importer, they want their 100,000 pieces back. Or if I'm going to destroy it, we have to assure that we've destroyed 100,000 pieces and 50,000 didn't go out the back door to be sold at a flea market or something like that.
Lisa Santana Fox, Director of the Fines, Penalties and Forfeitures Division for Cargo and Conveyance Security at Customs and Border Protection. We'll return with more of the interview after the short break. I'm Tom Temin.